Hello, everyone, and welcome to another session brought to you by AIRS LA, the Audio Internet Reading Service of Los Angeles. My name is Nancy Porter, and it is my pleasure to share Time Magazine with you. I need to remind you, you're listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on AIRS LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers, and no unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. I will be sharing, finishing up the September 8th issue of Time Magazine, and we will begin with the View inbox, and we'll start with a column by the editor at large, Jeffrey Kluger, and it's Health Matters. The idea of sleeping on a problem and seeing if you can get some clarity in the morning is a common one, but is it scientifically sound? A growing body of research says yes. The latest is a small study published in the Journal of Neuroscience. A group of 25 people did a memorization task while wired up so the researchers could monitor which portions of their brains lit up as they worked. Everyone then took an afternoon nap with brain sensors still in place. The researchers were looking for bursts of activity that occur in the brain during a relatively light stage of sleep. It was especially high in the same areas of the brain that were used in the memorization task, and the greater the activity, the more people improved at the task when they tried it after the nap. Alyssa Sinclair, a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania, found something similar in a study published last year. After sleeping on a difficult task, people were more level-headed the next day. When we let them sleep on it, they made somewhat more rational choices, she said. This is due largely to the region of the brain known as the hippocampus, which is responsible for processing short-term memories and, during sleep, helping to determine which of those memories will be transferred to long-term storage and which will essentially be deleted. When we're asleep, says Sinclair, the hippocampus is hard at work, consolidating those memories and experiences from throughout the day. It does this by replaying things that were important and pruning away the things that were not important. All right, the next article, also on page 18, is titled The DC Brief by Philip Elliott, Senior Correspondent. In normal times, the first Friday of the month brings a routine tranche of government data known as the monthly jobs report. The markets react, the politicians preen, and most Americans just go about their day. But these are not normal times, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics is no longer in the safe zone of nonpartisanship, thanks to President Donald Trump's decision to can its chief because he didn't like the math. On August 1st, Trump summarily fired the Bureau of Labor Statistics Commissioner Erica McDarfer after her team of stats mavens revised downward the job numbers for May and June. Trump decided the revisions were an effort to embarrass him and stoked conspiracy theories of rigged spreadsheets. It was the equivalent of firing a National Weather Service meteorologist because he spotted a hurricane and said something about it. This is about much more than a headcount of Americans showing up to work. The Bureau of Labor Statistics, an independent shop inside the Department of Labor that's run by a Senate-confirmed geek, is a warehouse of quants whose products shape everything from interest rates and investment payouts to strategic decisions made by individual businesses. The Bureau of Labor Statistics is an army of 2,000 nerds whose huge, but quiet, sway over the global economy is based large part on the confidence that they do not cook the books. On September 5th, the federal government was scheduled to release its first job report since Trump fired McTarver. The reactions to those numbers was likely to be colored by her dismissal. If, say, the report shows hiring surges in August, will investors even believe it now? Trump's predecessors largely prioritized stability over showmanship, understanding the importance of projecting a steady hand from Washington since World War II reset the global order. Many of Trump's capricious choices, from his trade and tariff war tantrums to his repeatedly threatening to fire Federal Reserve chairmen, are undermining that perception. Many global leaders now see the United States' influence as shrinking, as so many of the country's decisions seem to have no obvious aim other than serving Trump's lust for chaos and affirmation. Around Washington, the daily whiplash has become routine. But the Bureau of Labor Statistics shift is something new. Even though presidents might not always like the report that crosses their desk each month, they could have confidence that they were getting an accurate as possible snapshot of the entire economy. The same can be said for Wall Street, which counts on the ledger to be an apolitical indicator. Good data helps not just the Fed, it helps the government, but it also helps the private sector, said Fed Chair Jay Powell 2 days before McTarver was sacked. The United States has been a leader in that for 100 years. Trump's impetuous act constitutes a huge risk, one that historically has never worked out. The Greek debt crisis that began in 2009 was the result of a Potemkin set of books. Argentina's 2001 default on international loans was the byproduct of fictional inflation numbers. In 1937, Joseph Stalin had his census chief shot and killed when his numbers contradicted what the Soviet leader had advertised. The unflattering numbers were buried in the Soviet archives until 1989. Trump has long fetishized such strongman bravado, but he also craves the approval of Wall Street, which has a thing for accurate, stable, and honest data, an indispensable service that Washington produced for decades with little drama. All right, moving now to page 19. Headline, Time CO2 Leadership Report. And this was written by Justin Warland, the senior correspondent. It's hard to think of a policy move that could more directly target the core of climate science than the Trump administration's July 29th decision to undo the Environmental Protection Agency's endangerment finding. Reached by the Environment Protection Agency in 2009, it outlines how greenhouse gas emissions threaten public health and welfare, thereby laying out the legal basis for the agency to regulate those pollutants. The finding is the linchpin of EPA climate regulation, affecting everything from automobiles to power plants. Successfully undoing it would help the administration swiftly reverse a slew of climate rules. The Department of Energy also released an accompanying report launching a full frontal assault on the scientific consensus on climate change. In the hours that followed, my inbox filled with statements decrying the move as devastating and reckless, for understandable reasons. But the precise effects are difficult to predict. For one, it isn't immediately obvious that the rollback will survive the litigation that will challenge it, even with an increasingly conservative judiciary. One reason is the faulty scientific basis for the decision. Another is the legal precedent established in the 2007 Massachusetts versus EPA decision, which gave the agency the authority to regulate greenhouse gases if they endanger public health. And finally, Congress included language in the Inflation Reduction Act that clarified that greenhouse gas emissions count as pollutants. That language remains, even after Trump's one big beautiful bill gutted the law. In the years that litigation plays out, companies will be left in a state of confusion. Will they ultimately have to comply with some version of existing regulations if courts don't side with the Trump administration? Will a future administration impose even more stringent regulations? Will states come up with regulations of their own? Longer term, expect a whole constellation of factors, from tighter regulation in foreign markets to technology developments, to provide an incentive for lower emission technologies. At some point, perhaps, Congress might even craft legislation that gives more direct guidance on how the EPA should regulate greenhouse gases. I don't say any of this to diminish the decision's weight. It is certainly significant that as the costs of climate change become more evident, the United States government would make such an egregious attack on climate science. Nonetheless, EPA regulations aren't the primary driver pushing companies to decarbonize. Large companies are subject to regulations globally, and technological advances mean that energy systems are, in general, getting cleaner and greener because of economics. Nixing the endangerment finding is a roadblock, but it is not the total end of the story. All right, we move now to the section, the main section of the issue, the 100 most influential people in artificial intelligence. Obviously, there's not time to highlight all 100 of them, but I hope I've made a representative sampling of influential people in the field of artificial intelligence. We'll start with their first one, under the section called Leaders. This concerns Matthew Prince, the CEO of Cloudflare. This was written by Billy Parigio. Matthew Prince had to be converted to the belief that artificial intelligence is eating the web. It was 18 months ago that he started getting calls from media executives who complained to him about artificial intelligence companies copying articles to train their models without compensation. Prince's first reaction, he says, was to roll his eyes. Media companies are always complaining about whatever the new technology is, he tells Time magazine. But then Prince, the CEO of the internet security company Cloudflare, ran the numbers. His company has 10 years of web traffic data, a byproduct of its main service, that of protecting sites from being knocked offline by surges in traffic or targeted attacks. What he found shocked him. With the arrival of AI overviews to Google search results, the data showed news sites have begun finding it 10 times as hard to get traffic as they did a decade ago, he claims. The same metric for chatbots like ChatGPT and Claude is even worse, he says. The problem is that as the web shifts from a search-driven interface to an artificial intelligence-driven interface, fewer and fewer people are going to consume the original content, says Prince, who with his wife owns a local newspaper in his hometown of Park City, Utah. And that means that the incentives for creating content go away. Cloudflare was uniquely positioned to offer a solution. In July, the company began blocking by default the crawler bots that comb the web for training data to send back to AI companies. That is significant because Cloudflare's network covers some 20% of the entire internet, effectively putting one-fifth of the web behind a wall that only AI bots cannot ascend. The move was welcomed by dozens of media companies, including Time Magazine, plus authors and artists who have trailed against the big tech argument that training AI systems on their work comes under the fair use provision of copyright law, meaning compensation is not legally necessary. Funnily enough, Prince says most of the leading artificial intelligence companies, which are also Cloudflare customers, welcomed his company's intervention. It's because they don't want to be suckers, he says. It can't be that you pay to license content, but your competitors get it for free. Cloudflare's blockage, Prince believes, might be the first step toward a new business model for the internet. He doesn't quite know yet what it will look like, but he surmises that Cloudflare, as a result of its gatekeeper role, might be able to play market maker. That might mean Cloudflare eventually becomes a place where websites can name their price for AI companies to train on their data, and then charges fees on those transactions. This pay-per-crawl model could be a substantial new source of revenue for Cloudflare's already highly profitable business. It also marks a new gloves-off era for the company. In an August blog, Cloudflare fired a shot at the AI search engine Perplexity, which it accused of scraping content even from sites that had explicitly asked to be exempt from crawlers. Perplexity denied the accusation, calling it a sales pitch. According to Prince, the old era of the web, defined over the past 30 years by the primacy of the search engine, is coming to an end. The next 30 years, he says, will be totally defined by artificial intelligence. To him, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Prince argues that search engines bear responsibility for many of today's problems because they have taught everyone that the deity that content creators need to chase is traffic. That hasn't always created good incentives, he says, pointing to clickbait headlines, and rage-inducing videos. Prince has a vision for the AI-first internet, a world where content creators are incentivized not by ad revenue, but by AI companies, which will reward humans for chasing and furthering human knowledge to fill gaps in their training data. I'm optimistic that if we get this right, it unlocks a golden age of content creation, Prince says. My utopian vision is a world where humans get content for free and robots have to pay a ton for it. All right, we move now to Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI. Sam Altman started the year standing next to President Donald Trump as he announced a $500 billion data center project, Stargate, that OpenAI stands to hugely benefit from. A similar project is planned in the United Arab Emirates. Altman has also been attempting to convert OpenAI into a for-profit company, which would unlock tens of billions in new capital. All the while, OpenAI churns out new research. In early August, it launched the long-awaited GPT-5, which Altman compared to a PhD-level expert. The next leader being highlighted is Elon Musk, the CEO of xAI. Last year, xAI built the world's largest supercomputer, and in July, it released Grok 4, which it touted as the world's most intelligent model after beating rivals on various benchmarks. Integrated into Elon Musk's social platform, X, Grok has amassed at least 35.1 million monthly active users. And xAI has signed a near $200 million contract with the U.S. Department of Defense. But an earlier version of Grok, which Musk has called anti-woke, made headlines for praising Adolf Hitler. xAI apologized and deactivated the update. And that short article was written by Harry Booth. The next leader being headlined is Andy Jassy, the CEO of Amazon. Amazon is making a big push into AI, announcing multiple products and services, including Amazon Bedrock, which allows customers to build generative AI applications on Amazon's cloud computing platform called Amazon Nova. Its suite of foundation AI models, and Amazon Q, a generative AI assistant. It's also taking on NVIDIA with its Trainium chips. In December, Amazon Web Services announced it was building a massive AI supercomputer featuring hundreds of thousands of Trainium chips to be used by Anthropic. This was written by Ajisha Javid. All right, the next leader being highlighted is Alexander Wang and Nat Friedman. They are co-leads of Meta Superintelligence Labs. Alexander Wang, Scale AI's co-founder, and Nat Friedman, the one-time CEO of GIT Hub, are joining forces to lead a new vision within Meta that aims to bring personal superintelligence to everyone, according to Mark Zuckerberg. Superintelligent AI is a hypothetical system that is smarter than humans. In a policy paper co-authorized shortly before he joined Meta, Wang warned that superintelligent AI could be the 21st century's nuclear bomb. Now, he and Fieldman are responsible for helping build that technology inside a company with more than 3 billion users worldwide. All right, the next leader we will look at is Vijay Simo, the CEO of Application OpenAI. Despite rapidly becoming one of history's most valuable startups, OpenAI runs significant losses, estimating it lost $5 billion last year. in her newly created role, Fidji Simo, previously Instacart CEO, is tasked with steering the company toward profitability. The former Facebook executive, who calls herself a pragmatic technologist, says her role is to turn OpenAI's breakthrough research into products and services that can be used in the real world. My core belief is that any technology, but AI in particular, should empower people, and that this empowerment should be distributed to all instead of concentrating for just a few. All right, let's move on to Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta. Mark Zuckerberg's strategy rests on the three pillars of modern AI development: masses of data, huge computing power, and brilliant researchers to drive algorithmic progress. Meta has the first in spades, that is, masses of data. In an attempt to secure the other two, Meta is spending tens of billions of dollars on computing power and talent, bringing in Scale AI co-founder Alexander Wang, as well as researchers from rivals including OpenAI and Google DeepMind. Zuckerberg aims to create personal superintelligence, which users can interact with through Meta's smart glasses that can see what we hear what we hear, and interact with us throughout the day, he wrote in July. All right, the next person, the next leader being highlighted, Dario Amodei, the CEO of Anthropic. Anthropic has made a reputation as the responsible little brother in the AI race, arguing in support of regulation and safety methods, even as it races to train and deploy ever larger AI systems. Dario Amodei was one of the few AI CEOs who argued against a proposed block on states regulating the technology for 10 years. Senators eventually stopped the measure. Amodei has also warned about AI eliminating jobs. It doesn't hurt the business. Anthropic's chatbot, Claude, is popular for its coding power, prowess, and creative bent, and Anthropic's annualized revenue has quadrupled in 6 months off the back of that success. And that snippet was written by Billy Parigio. All right, the next section on AI influential people is titled Innovators. The first one is Natasha Lyonne, co-founder of Asteria. She's co-founder of Asteria Film Company. I've always been such a punk filmmaker, Natasha Lyonne muses, but AI is the thing that's going to flip me into a hippie, because now's the time to get super low to the ground and human. Lyonne has established herself as one of Hollywood's most eccentric, probing creatives. A lifelong actor, she received acclaim as a show creator for her mind-bending Netflix show titled Russian Doll, in which her protagonist, a software engineer, gets stuck in a time loop. This year, Lyonne is taking her futuristic bent even further with the creation of an AI film studio titled Asteria Film Company and a movie titled Uncanny Valley, which she is making with the help of AI tools. These projects make Lyonne one of the most high-profit entertainers to embrace AI, a decision that has garnered backlash from those who feel that the technology is antithetical to human creativity. Lyonne understands the criticism. She has plenty of her own about the industry. but there is no way around the mountain, she says. I think it's crucial that we level up as a community and situate ourselves correctly for this sea change. When ChatGPT stormed into the mainstream 2 years ago, some envisioned a future in which entire screenplays would be created by simple directives. For instance, write me a TV show just like Friends. This approach repulses Leon. I am definitely not interested in prompting my way to a screenplay or film or anything, she says. ChatGPT will tell you crazy things. It's too easily suggestible. Rather, she became interested in how AI filmmaking tools could give her more autonomy as a rising filmmaker on a budget. Leon says the types of movies that she typically gets offered to direct are two gals on the side of the road. But Leon, who is an ambitious, circuitous thinker, wanted to keep making art that built upon the scale and richness of Russian Doll, fusing sci-fi, history, and metaphysical exploration. Advanced AI tools now allow her to reduce the costs of visual effects or other post-production tools. Asteria, which Leon created with filmmaker and her boyfriend, Bryn Muser, is a subsidiary of Moon Valley, an AI startup founded by Google DeepMind researchers. Their video model, Mary, M-A-R-E-Y, which was trained on fully licensed data, allows filmmakers to input storyboards or frames and change details like coloring, composition, or even faces. Leon is currently using Mary on her upcoming film, Uncanny Valley. Written by Leon with screenwriter Britt Marling and technologist Jaron Lanier, the movie follows a teenage girl who becomes lost inside of an augmented reality video game. Before, you never would have had the option to make an independent film at true visionary scale, Leon says. Asteria is also using Mary for a documentary about astronomer Carl Sagan to restore and tweak archival footage. Critics worry that AI will cheapen filmmaking. But I knew we're doing it the right way because I'm on the floor. It's us, she says. We show each other ideas and drawings and put them through Mary and start building out that world. It's totally a tactile art form. Many in Hollywood also worry that the tools will simply replace human jobs. Just 2 years ago, Hollywood's major unions fought fiercely for and won AI protections in contracts. Leon concedes that in some cases, the technology could be used in a way that would actually be taking away jobs and doing something poorly and not creatively and not interesting, she says. That would be lame. She hopes that instead, the future of Hollywood will respect artists' rights and empower both filmmakers shooting on 16mm and those using AI to build. The magic trick of this whole thing is figuring out how to force us all to put our hands together and agree to integrity together, she says. Even those in Hollywood who are pushing most adamantly for AI protections don't believe that they can prohibit it entirely. I absolutely support the idea of technology companies that engage on an ethical basis, says Duncan Crabtree Ireland, the national executive director of SAG-AFTRA. That's the Screen Actors Guild and the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists. Leon has been contemplating how AI could lead society toward dystopia. Sometimes my brain will skip into a deep future where the memory of things like novels or a Spielberg film about romance seems so soft and sweet. if in fact we are to head into this great world of code, she says. I think that we're all a little bit over our heads with this tech wave, personally. Still, she feels like she doesn't have a choice but to engage. I understand the spark that AI invokes in people. Life is scary, she says. The fact of the matter is that it's upon us. Best we dive in, I think. And that was written by Andrew R. Chow. All right, the next innovator. No, then we move on to the area called shapers. And the first one we'll look at is Stuart Russell, the co-founder of ISEA. Stuart Russell receives 4 or 5 emails a day from people who seem to be in the grips of psychosis, convinced their AI chat box of choice is suddenly conscious. It's appointing them as its emissary to the human race. And in many cases, it's directing them to contact me so we can warn humanity or usher in the human machine symbiosis or whatever it is, he tells Time Magazine. I have had some heartbreaking letters from family members. Still, it's no surprise that AI systems would direct people to Russell. A computer science professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who co-authored the field's most used textbook and is among its most respected figures. Since 2013, he's been warning the world that building AI systems more intelligent than humans, when we still do not reliably know how to control them, could destroy civilization. In February, leaders in government and industry gathered in Paris for the 3rd Global AI Action Summit. It was widely viewed as a missed opportunity to reach consensus on how to manage AI's risks, existential or otherwise. It was sort of a low-budget trade show in the end, Russell says. Arguably, the more significant event had happened a week before, when Russell convened the inaugural meeting of the International Association for Safe and Ethical AI. So that's where the name AISEAI came from. There were many people and over 100 organizations concerned with AI ethics and safety, but they had no collective voice and so no collective means of action, Russell says. It's that, he says, that led him to co-found IASEIAI. Over 2 days, more than 700 people and an additional 1,400 online gathered to discuss what it might take to ensure artificial intelligence systems are proverbially beneficial for humanity. The conference, which featured talks from experts, including Nobel laureates like AI godfather Geoffrey Hinton, economist Joseph Stiglitz, and journalist Maria Ressa, marked a milestone in how we discuss AI's risks. Historically, there has been a divide between those concerned with issues of AI ethics, like AI's capacity for bias, discrimination, and generating misinformation, along with its impact on labor and the environment, and those concerned with issues of AI safety, like losing control over the technology and its capacity to unintentionally cause harm in pursuit of a misspecified goal. But these distinctions have always been artificial, says Russell, emphasizing that the concerns exist on a continuum, all rooted in the desire to ensure AI systems don't hurt people. Having brought ethics and safety advocates together, IASEAI is now setting itself up for the long term, aiming to further extend community, promote research, and shape policy. Another meeting is planned for next year in Paris. Russell frames the race to build increasingly advanced AI systems, often referred to as artificial general intelligence, AGI, a fuzzy term referring to systems more capable than humans across almost all domains, as the biggest technology project in human history. If the hundreds of billions of dollars committed over coming years all materialize, he estimates the expenditure could be 25 times that of the Manhattan Project, even adjusting for inflation. Russell is careful to calibrate his estimates. He thinks there's a 50% chance AGI is not developed quickly enough to satisfy investors, stalling progress, and only a 30% chance that it can be built under the present paradigm. But given the stakes, the risks are completely unacceptable. Russell thinks it's unlikely that governments will pass meaningful regulation absent a major disaster. Effective regulation requires solving a sweep of technical, policy, and enforcement problems. But we've done it before, he says, pointing to collective action to fix the ozone layer and prohibit human cloning. If frontier AI companies can't comply with regulations that reduces risk to an acceptable level, they should not be permitted to release their systems, he says. In his closing address as the IASEAI conference, Russell offered a stark metaphor. It's as if everyone in the world is getting onto a brand new kind of airplane that has never existed or been tested before, he said. It's going to take off, and it's never going to land. The engines can't fail. The navigation can't fail. The altimeter can't fail. It has to fly forever and not crash, because the whole human race is in that airplane. That is the situation that we're in. And that was written by Theron Pillay. And the next shaper we'll look at is Henna Virkkunen, EVP Tech, European Commission. Last year, the European Union became the first global power to pass comprehensive regulation governing AI. But Executive Vice President of Technology, Security, and Democracy, Henna Virkkunen, aims to show the Union can be more than a rulemaker. In April, she unveiled Europe's plan to become a leading AI continent. It calls for simplifying the very rules that defined its regulatory rule. She's promised to cut red tape, leading efforts to streamline compliance through a voluntary code of practice. Her plan also calls for constructing 5 AI gigafactories. And that was written by Harry Booth. And the next shaper we'll look at is David Sachs, AI and Crypto Czar in the U.S. Venture capitalist heavyweight David Sachs is Silicon Valley's man on the inside in Washington. In his role as White House AI and crypto czar, he's advocated that the U.S. move rapidly to beat China in an AI arms race. In May, Sachs assisted the president on a tour of the Middle East, where the United States shook hands on a $600 billion chip and data center deal with Saudi Arabia and a massive data center build-out in the United Arab Emirates. Sachs and advisors revealed the White House's AI action plan in July, which put forward a set of policy recommendations to loosen restrictions around the technology, including environmental rules. All right, and we'll finish this section on shapers with Fei-Fei Li, a professor at Stanford University. Godmother of AI, Fei-Fei Li, co-directs the Stanford Institute for Human-Centered AI and helps shape global AI governance, beginning with California, the world's technology capital. In June, she published a research-informed AI policy report for Governor Gavin Newsom, including recommendations for guardrails on transparency, independent oversight, and whistleblower protections. She is also the co-founder and CEO of World Labs, which raised $230 million in September of 2024. The startup aims to create large world models that perceive the 3D world, the way large language models understand language, with potential applications like fight training simulations, physics experiments, or even urban planning. And we finish the section on shapers with Duncan Crabtree Ireland, the executive director of SAG-AFTRA, the two entertainment unions. As head of Hollywood SAG-AFTRA, Duncan Crabtree Ireland has been forging protections for workers whose livelihoods are threatened by AI. In July 2024, he led a strike of 2,600 workers against video game companies aiming to create digital replicas of actors' performances. The two sides later ratified a contract that included AI provisions requiring the transparency, consent, and compensation for the use of AI-generated replicas. The union has won improved language related to AI with movie producers, major record labels, and commercial advertisers. Oops, and the last one is Randy Weingarten, the president of Associated Federation of Teachers. In July, Randy Weinbergen revealed a new AI training initiative for teachers with $23 million in funding from the likes of Microsoft, OpenAI, and Anthropic. The program will host hands-on workshops to teach educators how to use AI in the classroom. Starting with a flagship campus in New York City, the plan is to train up to 400,000 educators or 1 in 10 U.S. teachers by the year 2030. Educators will learn to use AI to draft or refine lesson plans and brainstorm student project ideas, among other teacher-led suggestions. And at that point, we will stop our coverage of the September 8th issue of Time Magazine. I need to remind you again that you've been listening to a recording provided for the use of the blind and print impaired. Items read on Airs LA are the copyright property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Again, my name is Nancy Porter, and it has been my pleasure to share Life Magazine with you. I'm sorry, Time Magazine with you.